സിസ്റ്റർ സെൻക സിസിലിയ ഷെല്ലിംഗ് ബിഫോർ ദ കോർട്ട്. ബൈ ദ ടൈം ദ ഹിയറിംഗ് ടുക്ക് പ്ലേസ് അറ്റ് ദ സ്റ്റേറ്റ് കോർട്ട് ഇൻ ബ്രാറ്റിസ്ലാവ, സിസ്റ്റർ സെൻക ഹാഡ് ഓൾറെഡി അണ്ടർഗോൺ ഇന്യൂമറബിൾ ഇൻട്രോഗേഷൻസ്. ഫ്രം ദ ഒഫീഷ്യൽ റെക്കോർഡ്സ് വി നോ ദാറ്റ് ദ കോർട്ട് പ്രൊസീജിയർ ടുക്ക് പ്ലേസ് അബൌട്ട് 4 months ആഫ്റ്റർ ഹെർ അറസ്റ്റ് on 17th June 1952. It is hard to imagine what Sister Senga suffered during those months and in the 2 years that followed. Cecilia Schilling, religious sister and nurse at the government hospital at Bratislava, was the first defendant whose name was called out. The second defendant was Katerina Lukavovic, a nurse, and the third a government official of the Central National Committee, ZNK, Martha Sattner. The fourth defendant was a man, Joseph Juran, a truck driver working at the hospital at Bratislava, Department of Infectious Diseases. From the bill of indictment, we gather that the Court of Justice in Bratislava declared Cecilia Schilling, Katerina Lukakovic, and Marta Sattner guilty of high treason. In the same document, defendant Cecilia Schilling is called archenemy of the people's democracy. She was accused of having offered and actually given assistance to fugitives. In doing so, she had collaborated with Katerina Lukakovic in contacting a prison warden. After 22nd February 1952, that is after a certain priest by the name Titus Zeman and others had been convicted of high treason, they had helped these offenders to escape from prison. In this way, 5 priests who had been condemned for high treason and espionage, Titus Zeman, Andrej Dermek, Justin Benuska, William Mitozinka, and Pavol Povki, had been able to escape and evade punishment. By extending this assistance, the 3 women had themselves become guilty of high treason, for which the maximum penalty was imposed at that time. The Court of Justice sentenced Cecilia Schilling to 12 years, Maria Sattner to 7 years, and Katerina Lukakovic to 11 years imprisonment. The sentence for the driver Joseph Juran was comparatively much milder. He was deprived of his liberty for 10 months only. Much later, it would be proved that this driver was an agent of the state who had been asked to spy on the women and ultimately to betray them. He had accomplished this task strictly according to the orders received from his bosses. Sister Zenga in the juridical acts consequently called Cecilia Schilling was not conscious of any guilt. However, she signed the following statement in the presence of a member of the state security: I acknowledge the indictment and the date of trial, but I do not feel guilty. I confess to having performed the action of which I am accused, but I deny the accusation of high treason. I acted under the impression created by the warden, who said the five priest prisoners were to be transported to Siberia, where they would be killed. I made the decision to help them prepare for the flight out of pure compassion. Obviously, I was very naive in believing the threats of the warden. But this does not make me an enemy of the People's Republic. I do not know of any further declarations or details. In signing the text, Zenga testified that she did help the prisoners but did not feel guilty of treason for having done so. On 23rd November 1950, she wrote a letter from a prison in Rimavska Sobota to her fellow sisters, in which she emphasized the same facts. On 9th June 1952, the court at Bratislava had informed the presiding committee of the court at Prague as follows. In the court case against Cecilia Schelling and companions accused of subversive activities, the date of 17th June 1952 has been set for the main proceedings, which are to last for about one day. Number of accused 4. Indictment: the defendants wanted to facilitate the flight of four Roman Catholic priests of the group of Titus Zeman, who had been apprehended for high treason, attested by Pavel Korbuli, President of the Senate. This Korbuli added by way of supplement, "There is considerable danger to society. The opinion of the public was not ascertained." Suddenly, this young woman, she was now 36, had become a danger to society and had therefore to be prevented from any further action. The process against the priest Titus Zeman had actually nothing to do with the one against Sister Zenga. The only thing the two cases had in common was the fact that both were conducted by this Pavel Korbuli. He had one sole aim in view, namely to carry on the fight against the church and its representatives. Years later, this judge repented his conduct bitterly. On 17th June 1952, as Sister Zenga sat on the defendant's bench, she was visibly marked by the great strain she had undergone during the previous months. She appeared to have aged considerably within those 4 months. Her fine features bore the imprint of pain and fear. Her body was emaciated, and it was not only what was visible to the eyes that bore the scars. The signs of repeated tortures, wounded, exposed without any care, she was dragged back to her cell after the interrogations and thrown down on the naked cement floor. At times, her exhaustion was such that she was utterly spent hardly knowing whether she was still alive or dead. When she awoke after a brief spell of unconsciousness, she was trembling all over with cold and pain. She was drained of all her reserves, and so she could answer only in whispers the questions addressed to her by the court officials. At the consciousness of standing despite everything under God's protection enabled her to survive all her afflictions. According to eyewitnesses who had visited her in the different prisons where she had been detained, Zhuzhenga was never heard complaining nor wailing. Apollonia Galis was one of those persons. She lives today as a Holy Cross sister in Trnava, where in 1955 Sister Zhuzhenga died at the age of 39. Apollonia Galis. Apollonia Galis had always maintained her connection with Sister Zhuzhenga. She visited her in prisons, smuggled in cakes into which she had baked vitamins, and remained loyal to her till the last day. In 1950, she was visited the convict, also in Rimavska Sobota. Sister Zhuzhenga, pale and emaciated, sat at a big table. Behind her stood an attendant who observed her closely. We spoke mainly about her family, with whom I had made contact. In between, I tried to get some information about the condition of the prisoner. After my second visit, I met the warden, who was about to bring blood samples of Sister Zhuzhenga to the laboratory. This warden hailed like Sister Zhuzhenga from Orava. She felt sorry for young Cecilia Schilling. And later she smuggled Sister Zhuzhenga's letters out of the prison. One letter of 2 pages still exists. It is a desperate outcry begging for an improvement of her living conditions. She also asked for medical treatment outside the prison. The letter was read hand and concluded with the sentence, "No one knows why I have to be in prison." In the prison of Rimavska Sobota, Cecilia Schilling lived with other convicts, some of whom were criminals, murderers, sex offenders, and thieves. After a drastic deterioration in her health, cancer of the breast was diagnosed. Probably a consequence of the torture she had undergone. She was brought to the hospital for prisoners at Prague, where she underwent surgery. At the beginning of their prison term, convicts were given a uniform. The women had to wear a long shirt, which they were allowed to alter according to their size. A fellow prisoner who survived her sentence, Emilia Lossert, recalls how Zhuzhenga transformed the shapeless shirt into a well-fitting skirt and blouse. She had a talent for seeing presentable even in prison. a sign that she still had a positive philosophy of life. Her joy in life and her strong desire to change her difficult situation found expression also in letters addressed to her parents, friendships developing among prisoners. It was an everyday occurrence that without any reason, convicts were suddenly shifted to another place. Emilia Lossert recalls, suddenly one got an order and had to depart immediately, or one would have been forcibly evicted from one's cell. Packing was done in no time, the prison kitchen. So we departed with an increased sense of loneliness and defenselessness, doing what we were ordered to do. In Rimavska Sobota, Stasenka was twice visited by her relatives. Her mother distressed over her daughter's condition, and her youngest brother Cyril took to the road and knocked with trepidation at the prison gate. The director gave permission for the visit, but made it clear that mother and brother were not to express any emotion. If this stipulation was not fulfilled, the visit would be cut short by the warden before the time set for it was over. This was an altogether inhuman demand made on Stasenka's nearest relatives. They met their daughter and sister under the worst possible conditions. They saw the change she had undergone. She was emaciated and her face was marked by strain and pain, and they had to hide their emotions. Only their eyes could give expression. The prison building was in a greatly decayed condition, and this added to the bleak atmosphere. The walls were grey and damp, the prison bars rusty, and there was a musty smell in the corridors. The wardens appeared to the shellings to be like robots, doing their duty by remote control. Most of them were in fact psychopaths, psychologically disturbed persons with more or less sadistic leanings. In this connection, we have a report by Gus Stasenka herself. After the amputation of her breast and while hovering between life and death, she entrusted this report to Helena Koda, herself a convict. Helena Koda had volunteered to take care of the patient after her operation, to nurse her as far as this was possible. Very Stasenka related the torments she had undergone. There was an attempt made to extract confessions from me. When I refused to tell lies, the wardens led me to a room where there was a big water container. Into this I was thrown. With my clothes on and my head was held under water until I could hardly breathe. Only when I was close to suffocation, gasping for breath, was I allowed to emerge. Again I refused to lie, and the procedure was repeated as often as 10 times a day. Only when I was nearly unconscious was this torture discontinued. Black glasses were then put on my eyes and drained of all strength. I was dragged through the corridors of the prison to be thrown into a cell with no windows. There I remained lying in wet clothing on the cold floor. I can no longer remember how long this torture lasted. When I regained consciousness, I searched for something on which to lay my aching head. Since I could not find anything in the bare cell, I took off my shoes and placed them under my head. At least they were softer than the cold cement floor. During the days of interrogation, Zhizhenka was kept in a single cell with neither window nor any artificial lighting. Once in a while, a glimmer of light blinked through a slit in the door. Thus she sat in the dark room, shivering with the cold and fear. Her already frail body was more and more weakened by her state of uncertainty and constant fear. I no longer knew whether it was day or night. Neither can I remember how often and how long I was in solitary confinement. After periods of waiting that seemed endless, I was suddenly transferred to another cell, where I was given food and drink to improve my appearance when I was summoned before the court. Apparently, Zhizhenka was a victim marked out for special torture. Her patience, her unwavering faith in God's protection provoked the prison guards. Rather than swiftly end the prisoner's life, the sadistic streak in their personality caused them to drain away the psychic strength of their victims. Little by little, though it was well known that Zhizhenka, as a religious sister, had no financial means, she was even asked with what derision and humiliation to meet the readings. On the day of her arrest, the state security had already been able to convince themselves that Sister Zhizhenka had nothing but her clothes and other items of daily use, namely religious dress and undergarments, veil, and the cross of her order. A written record of these articles was made on the day of her apprehension. On 20th October 1952, Zhizhenka protested against this demand that she pay the expenses of the court to the Supreme Court in Prague with a copy to the State Court in Bratislava. The undersigned convict Cecilia Schilling, at present detained in the prison of Rimavská Sobota, herewith files a complaint against a decision taken by the State Court of Bratislava on 8th October 1952 concerning payment of the court proceedings number 3, TS 3rd 43 bar 52. With this application, I permit myself to ask for remission of the cost incurred during my detention for investigation and the court proceedings that followed for the reason given below. I do not possess any property. Being a religious sister, I could never save anything, since my monthly income of 1,000 Czech crowns or currency was just enough to cover immediate needs. It will neither be possible for me to pay the above amount in future. In the meantime, I have become an invalid suffering from spinal tuberculosis. Neither does my mother have an income, for she lives on a social pension. Thanking you for a favorable settlement of this matter, Cecilia Schelling, Rimonska Sobota, 22nd 1052. According to an excerpt from the letter of the court, the payment demanded amounted 4,710 crowns. When the authorities hesitated, the superior of the Holy Cross Convent at Bratislava, Sister Timotia Mikus, interfered, stating, "The convict Cecilia Schelling does not possess any valuables. She was a religious sister and a nurse at the State Hospital of Bratislava, and therefore not in a position to put aside any savings." At this point, it must be mentioned that not all her fellow sisters by far approved of Sister Zenga's attitude and actions. There were many who interpreted the assistance she had offered to people in grave danger as disobedience. While she had acted out of kindness and compassion. Moreover, church authorities had issued strict warnings against any action that might provoke the representatives of the regime. With this reticence, they wanted to avoid provoking additional hatred and additional problems, in the hope that this would enable them to continue without scandal and further disturbance. The little they were still permitted to do. Most likely, they also feared further persecutions and repressions. The experience of lack of understanding and criticism coming from her own ranks was extremely painful for Sister Zenga. She felt left alone in her conviction that there is no greater love than this, to give one's life for one's friends. John chapter 15 verse 13. After Rimonska Sobota, Sister Zenga was taken away from prison to prison was not over by far. What the convicts feared most was a transfer to Pardubice, a prison in Bohemia, which had been set up according to the pattern of the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. During World War II, many people had lost their lives in this camp. After the war, convicts found again and again remains of unfortunate people who had attempted to escape this hell. Through tunnels they had dug with their own bare hands. Sister Zenga was not spared a stay within the walls of Pardubice. From Rimonska Sobota, she was sent for a short time to the hospital in Prague, and from there to Brno, presumably Because she needed radiation therapy in this prison, the inmates corresponded with each other through Morse code. It was part of the warden's ambitions to discover these secret messages, to prove those responsible guilty, and to punish them for breaking rules. The director of the prison sought to win over the new convict Cecilia Schilling to becoming an informer. It would be her task to listen to secret messages, to decode them, and to hand the result over to the prison authorities. For this purpose, she was given an envelope and some paper. For Sister Zenga, there was of course no question of letting herself be used as a spy. After some time, she returned envelope and paper, just as she had received it. With this refusal to cooperate, she provoked the rage of the prison authorities. She had to count on serious consequences, and this consisted in her transfer to the dreaded Pertubis prison. There she was put into a single cell, was given just enough to eat to keep her alive, and at night she had to sleep on the hard, cold concrete floor. Apollonia Gallis, her faithful friend, visited her in this place of horror. Pardubis was indeed a sad place. I felt afraid inside those walls and wept bitterly when I had to leave without having been able to see Sister Zenga. I had hoped to speak a few words to her, but was given no chance. In the visitor's room, a wall had been put up with the crossbars, over which I could just see the head of my friend. She was now evidently very ill. The color of her face was gray. She implored me with her eyes to arrange for her release. This would have required much money, which neither I nor Sister Zenga's family possessed. So she had to stay for 11 months in that place of horror. On my return from the visit, I was depressed and desperate, and I searched for people who could help Sister Zenga. A doctor promised to do something. Years later, I came to know that those who had promised their help were traitors. Those who at that time held positions of power, including the prison personnel, pursued but one goal: to make the life of all their opponents quite unbearable. The convicts who had possessed the ruling regime in one way or another were considered such opponents.